Good afternoon and welcome to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. Yes, we are live. Yesterday we should have been live, but we had a bit of a technical difficulty. This time it was at my end. Sometimes the radio station has some problems with their phone service and or internet service. It closes us down a little bit. But I'm traveling. I'm in Spokane, Washington. I usually am in Southern California where I live. And when I travel, I often depend on an internet connection through a Verizon Jetpack, as it's called, which is a portable Wi-Fi hotspot that it uses the Verizon cellular signal and it converts it into Wi-Fi so that I can be that's why sometimes you hear me, I'm broadcasting from a car seat or a airport or something like that. I think I'll be doing it from an airport tomorrow. But in any case, it's extremely portable, and it makes this program, at least it makes my part of it, very portable. And it's great, except I've had this little device for years, and these things don't last forever. And a couple days ago, I was using it, and the program cut out a few times inexplicably, and I don't know if it was the problem with the device or not. But by the next day, the device was just going berserk. I mean, the screen was cycling through different things. It was clear. It was done. That device was done. So yesterday, before the show, I found a Verizon store not very far from where I'm staying, and of course there's lines there. And it took me a long time. And I did buy another hotspot, which I'm using right now, and I'm sure it's going to work fine. But I didn't get it before showtime, and so we had to play a recorded show because I had no way of hooking up until I got this thing replaced. So anyway, if you were listening yesterday and thought, wait, how come it's not live? That's why. Technical problem at my end. However, we should have no more problems like that for a while, I hope. And so we are live. You can call in as usual. Talk to me in real time. The number is 844-484-5737. And if you're not familiar with the program, this is a live Q&A, Bible Q&A. If you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity or the Christian faith or Christian life, I welcome your calls. If you have never heard the program before, I don't pretend that I know all the answers. But if I do know an answer, I'll give it to you, if I think I do. If I don't know the answer, then I'll be pretty sure that I don't, and I'll tell you so. So we just I don't claim to have all the answers, but maybe I'll have the answer to the question that you have in your mind, and you're welcome to call. Problem is that lines are full at the moment, so take this number down, and if you hope to call and say, just call in at random anytime after a few minutes from now, and you may just find lines have opened up. They do throughout the program. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And one more thing, maybe actually two more things. This is my last evening speaking in Spokane. I've been speaking here for about a week almost, and I'm speaking at a church called Livingstone Church. I've been speaking every evening, and tonight I'll be speaking also at 6 o'clock. If you're in the area, you may want to join us. You can find out information about that at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's under announcements. There's a tab that says announcements. And this Saturday, I'm doing a meeting that we do once a month in Buena Park, Southern California, where I live in Orange County, is where this meeting is. And we're going through the book of Zephaniah and Haggai. That might seem like a strange choice, but we've been for some years now at this monthly meeting going through the Bible. We're almost at the end of the Old Testament now. And these books are interesting books. If they interest you, feel free to join us this Saturday night in Buena Park. That meeting is held at the Way Fellowship in Buena Park, California. And if you don't know where that is, we have a map, we have instructions, we have all the information you need about this Saturday night in Buena Park at our website. So tonight in Spokane, Washington, Saturday night, day after tomorrow, we'll be in Buena Park. If you're interested in either of those meetings, we'd love to have you join us. You can find out by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and looking under the tab that says announcements. You'll get all the information, and you can join us if you'd like. All right, let's talk to John calling from Jackson, Wyoming. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve. Hey, I was saved as an adult about 40 years ago. And I had always heard about Jim Elliot, but just kind of the cursory fact, and I decided to do a little more research. So I'm reading the book Shadow of the Almighty.
Yeah, by his wife.
Oh, my gosh. What a life led by the Holy Spirit.
Awesome.
I mean, I am just awestruck by this guy.
He died very young, but he was an incredible witness. Yeah.
So my question is, had you ever had the chance to meet Elizabeth Elliot? And I understand that one of the Indian that actually killed Jim Elliot was saved and traveled in the U.S. to churches. I was wondering if you ever got a chance to either hear her or him.
Well, I've been familiar with Elizabeth Elliot almost all my life. Jim Elliot and his four companions were killed when I was a child in the 50s. And I was aware of their story because I was raised in the church, and I was aware of them. They became legends very quickly. So I've always known about Jim Elliot and about his wife. I mean, for those who don't know, Jim Elliot was a young American missionary who, with four other young American missionaries, went down to Ecuador to reach a murderous tribe of natives who had murdered previous missionaries some 50 years earlier. But they were zealous missionaries. They went down there, and sure enough, they got murdered by the tribe almost as soon as they landed. And so it was a very tragic thing. But Jim and Nate Saint and I think some of the others, their wives with children, in the case of Elizabeth Elliot, she had a three-year-old daughter, I believe, they went into the jungle and evangelized the natives that killed their husbands, which is amazing. And they succeeded where their husbands had desired to reach these people. Their wives actually succeeded. And so it's a tremendous story. I've always admired Elizabeth Elliot, not only for that, but she was always a very great Christian woman, Christian. She's very intelligent. She was a Bible college professor, or at least she lectured in Bible colleges. And she was just a great woman and very one of the most rational, people to listen to. And I don't remember her ever saying anything that I disagreed with, which is unusual. But and she's gone now. She had Alzheimer's in her final years and she died. But did I get a chance to meet her? Only once, when I was running my school in McMinnville, Oregon. She came to speak at a church in Portland, and I definitely made it out there to listen to her, and I had a chance to meet her. Of course, she wouldn't have remembered me. I was just one of the fans who met her after she spoke. Yes, I did. I never heard the Indian guy who got saved. I've never been in the same room with him ever, but I did have a chance to meet Elizabeth Elliot, who had been a hero of mine for years.
Well, it's just an all-inspiring book, and it's changing my life.
Good.
I had one other question for you, if I could, please.
Okay.
We live under the New Testament, and it's not an addendum to the Old Testament. So can you tell me what the significance of the Old Testament is to the Christian today?
Well, the Old Testament is made up of three basic divisions. One is the Torah, or the law. Another is the prophets, and another is what the Jews called the writings, the Tehillim. That includes the Psalms and Proverbs and some of those kinds of books. So if we ask what's the relevance of the Old Testament to us, well, the only thing I know of that's changed for us is the law, because the law was that which governed Israel's society under the Old Covenant. They were the nation of Israel, were God's special nation, special people, and their constitution and their bylaws and their, their whole government was based upon the law given at Mount Sinai, which included the Ten Commandments and 613 other laws. And they, a lot of those laws had to do with the, you know, the way they should offer sacrifices in the tabernacle. They included things like circumcising their children and keeping holy days. There were lots of laws like that. And then there were other laws among them that were more ethical or moral laws, you know, about murder and stealing and adultery and those kinds of things. Those are moral issues. So God, this, the whole law, the whole Torah, was given to Israel as part of the Old Covenant, and therefore the laws that he gave were obligatory to be obeyed under the Old Covenant. Now, Jesus came and made a new covenant. Jeremiah had predicted that there would be a new covenant. In Jeremiah 31, he said that God will make a new covenant that's not like the old one. One difference in it would be that the law would be written in their hearts, but there were other promises associated with it too. And it was not just a repeat or even an addendum, as you say, to the Old Covenant. It was a replacement of the Old Covenant. And that's what it says in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13. It says, where there's a new covenant, it's made the old one obsolete. So the Old Covenant with all those laws and stuff are obsolete because there's a new covenant now. And that means that when we, as Christians, if we're in the new covenant, that means that we now obey Jesus. He's the Lord and we must obey him in everything he says. But we don't consult the law as our law. The teaching of Christ would be more definitive of our duties. But that doesn't mean there's nothing to be learned from the law. The apostles taught from the law a great deal, and this is after the new covenant came. But they drew principles from it. I mean, for example, Paul brought out the fact that in the law, they were not allowed to plow with a donkey and an ox under the yoke together. And that's a strange law, certainly, but Paul saw symbolism in it. He said, you know, that means that a believer and an unbeliever should not be yoked together, because a donkey was an unclean animal under the law, and a ox was a clean animal. So you don't yoke the clean and the unclean together. And Paul saw that as a spiritual principle. There's also a law in there that said you shouldn't muzzle the ox while it's treading the grain. Once again, a kind of a strange law to have. It seems to be like animal rights kind of law. Paul actually quoted that twice, and he applied it to a spiritual thing. He said, he quoted it, you know, don't muzzle the ox as it treads out the grain. And then he said, now, does God care for oxen? Implying that he doesn't. That this was not a concern so much about animal rights, but to make a spiritual lesson. He said, and he saw that as a command that those who are serving God, like the oxen is serving his master, should not be muzzled. That is, they should not be prevented from eating. They should be supported. In others, Paul, as I said, quoted it twice, once in 1 Corinthians 9, and again, I think it was 1 Timothy 5. In both cases, he's talking about the rights of people who are in full-time ministry to be supported by those to whom they minister. So he saw spiritual lessons in some of these laws. Now, of course, Jesus himself repeated some of the laws for his disciples. Obviously, the moral laws, like don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness, those are moral laws, and moral laws are permanent. Moral laws existed before the Torah was given. It was wrong to murder and commit adultery before the Ten Commandments were given. It's always been wrong, and it always will be. We're not under the Ten Commandments, but it's still wrong to, you know, to commit adultery or murder and do those kinds of things, because those are moral standards based on the character of God, which never changes. So when we look at the law and we say, well, what's the relevance to us? We could say, well, the moral code of the law really is eternal. It was valid before the law was given. It was valid during the law, and is valid after the law passed away and the new covenant has come. But the things that were ritualistic parts of the law were only for Israel, and those have been fulfilled in Christ. So we're not under the law. We don't have to consult the law for our guide to how to live, although when we read it, we do see things there that Christ also repeated. We can see sometimes the law puts a finer point on a moral issue that still is a valid moral issue. And sometimes, as I said, a law that's not a moral issue, like don't muzzle the ox or don't plow with an ox and a donkey together, you know, we can see spiritual principles there, like Paul did. So we're not under the law. It's not the legal system that we as Christians have to comply with. We do have to comply with the law of Christ, what Christ said we have to do. Now, but then once we talk about that, the rest of the Old Testament really hasn't changed at all. I mean, the Psalms are still the Psalms. The Proverbs are still wisdom. The prophets still have prophesied things. And so many of the prophecies of the prophets were fulfilled in the past. And if any of them are not yet fulfilled, then they're as future for us as they were for them. So we, in other words, we have the same benefit from the prophets and from the Psalms and from the Proverbs and such as any people of any time would. So the Old Testament became the Old Testament was the only Bible that Jesus ever had or the apostles ever had. And it's the only Bible they ever preached from. So when Christians say, well, the Old Testament's no use to us, I guess Jesus and the apostles never got that memo, because they preached entirely from the Old Testament until, of course, the apostles wrote the New Testament. So, of course, the New Testament are the writings of the New Covenant, and we will learn far more from them what a Christian's specific duty is as a Christian than from the Old Testament. But the Old Testament is still valuable. We can gain lessons, including moral lessons, from the law, but most of the Old Testament isn't the law. It's history, for once. The history of Israel, the history of God dealing with his people. History's good. History's good for anybody. I mean, we learn all kinds of lessons from what God did with Noah or with Abraham or whatever. So the certainly more than half the Old Testament is historical narrative. So historical narrative doesn't change with the New Covenant. It's still history. The prophecies aren't really any different, except that more of them have been fulfilled. And as far as the Proverbs and the Psalms, Proverbs, you know, there's still wisdom, and we need wisdom. So, in other words, most of the Old Testament has the exact same benefit to us that it had to anybody at any time. But the law code does not apply to us as it applied to them, because we now have a new covenant with new stipulations. Those were the stipulations of the Old Covenant.
Thanks, Steve. Right. Love your show.
Okay. Thanks for talking, John. Hey, Paul from Toronto, Canada. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I've been listening to your verse by verse. And I mean, I just finished Hebrews chapter 11, and my question is about faith. Faith is the substance, which the Hebrew writer is saying, it is now ever present. It is present now. Our hope is now present. And therefore, we can enjoy and embrace it. And in Isaiah 38, Hezekiah was supposed to die, but he lived because he prayed. So he was given 15 years. And you also mentioned in one of your tapes that you have a couple, a young couple, and this woman was given a revelation by God that she was going to die, and even the specific date was given to her. But on the date that she was supposed to die, she went to the doctor, and the doctor said she's okay.
Yeah.
So then she refused to be prayed. Actually, she refused to be prayed because she received a message from God that she was going to die. So there's no reason. There's no point for her praying.
Uh huh.
My question is this. Faith is a substance. People who prayed are supposed to die. I mean, God gave them the message, who did not die because they prayed. And people who were supposed to die because God gave them a message and did not pray, did not pay for it and still did not die. But my question actually is this. Sorry to be long. Huh? My question is, there are people
told by
there are
the
people. Sorry.
Yeah, Hezekiah was told by the prophet Isaiah that it was time for him to die and that he should get his house in.
Yeah,
sent Isaiah back, say, okay, if you want to live longer, I'm going to give you 15 more years. And so he did give him 15 more years, which wasn't a good thing, because Hezekiah during those 15 years had a son who then became king at age 12 when Hezekiah died. And was the worst king they ever had, and he brought disaster on the country. So if Hezekiah had simply been resigned to die when God originally planned for him to, Israel would not have had that horrible king, because he wouldn't have been born yet. If we say, well, that seems severe to me, maybe that's because we don't understand what a severe thing it is to curse your parents. God's much more in touch with those things, and he informs us about them by telling us what penalties are deserved for those things. If we have come to a place where we simply ignore the command to honor our father and our mother, and we just figure, well, everyone dishonors their parents, so it's not that bad. No, that's not true. If we say all politicians lie and cheat.
Okay, did I cut out and they had to put in something? Okay, so anyway, I hope you heard what I was saying. Maybe you didn't. Maybe I cut out. So this lady said she was going to die and thought God told her that, and yet she didn't die. I saw her 5 years later, and she's still perfectly cancer-free. Whereas Hezekiah, God told him he was going to die, but that really was a word from the Lord. But God changed the plan in answer to Hezekiah's prayer, though it wasn't a very good prayer. I mean, it's understandable that someone might want to have a longer life, but it wasn't God's plan, and therefore God we switched from God's perfect will to God's permissive will, and that proved to be very bad in the long run for the nation. Anyway, you're reading Hebrews 11, you said, about faith, and it sounds like, this woman had faith that she would die, but she didn't. She was healed without faith. Hezekiah probably prayed with faith and was healed. So we find in the Bible many times, I've just gotten a message that I must have cut out and you missed most of the story. But the idea was that there's a woman who had cancer that I knew 40 years ago, and she believed that God had told her that she was going to die on a certain day. But when that day came, it turned out she was cancer-free. She did not pray to be healed, and she didn't want anyone else to pray that she'd be healed because she believed God wanted her to die, and she was ready to. But then she apparently misheard God. The question, you posed it in the context of your study of Hebrews 11 and what faith does. Many people think that faith is a guarantee. If you have enough faith, that you'll get what you pray for and you'll get what you want. In fact, in the Word of Faith teaching, which is very popular in some circles, the teaching is you'll have what you say. If you confess by faith that you're going to be well, you will. But if you confess that you're not going to be well, then you won't. This is a false teaching, but it's taught in many parts of the body of Christ. Well, it certainly is disproven in this case, in Janie's case, because she was confessing, we could say negatively. She was saying, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Don't pray for me to live. And yet she got healed. So it's just one of many, many, many experiences I've had that prove that even though we have faith, there's no guarantees that we will have what we say or what we're confident of. When we have faith in our prayers, the Bible says, Jesus said we're supposed to have faith in God. In other words, in God, not faith that God will do a certain thing, but faith in God, which means just like you hopefully have faith in your marriage partner, hopefully you have faith in them, or in your parents if they're honest people, or in, I was going to say government officials, but no one has faith in them anymore. But the point is you have friends that you believe in. You believe they're good people. You believe they're loyal. You believe you can trust them. That's faith in them. And that's what faith in God is like. You believe that you can trust him to do the right thing. You know he's good. You know he's wise. You know he can do all things well. And therefore, when you present your prayers to him, you realize that even if he hears those prayers and says, to tell the truth, I've got a better idea than that, so I'm not going to do what you said, that if God doesn't answer your prayer, you still have faith in him. You still say, okay, he must know what he's doing. I trust him. And lots of people think that faith means you believe in a thing. You believe in an event, in an outcome. I believe I'm going to be healed. Well, if God hasn't said you're going to be healed, then believing that you will be is simply presumption. You might be healed, but you've got no basis for believing it if God hasn't promised it. And God hasn't. God hasn't promised that everyone's going to be healed. But he does heal some people because it is his will to heal sometimes. And so our faith, again, doesn't have a direct one-to-one correspondence with outcomes. It has to do with our relationship with God, that whether he grants my request, which he will do if it's the best thing, or if he denies my request, which he will do if it's the best thing, that we still, no matter what he does, we believe in him. We believe he does the best thing, and that what he does is, in fact, the best thing. So that is my understanding of faith in relation to those stories you raised. Okay, let's talk to, we don't have time to talk yet. We have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. We have our lines full, so we'll try to get through, hopefully, all these calls in the next half hour. We take a break at this point every day simply because we don't have any other breaks in the show. We have no commercial breaks. We don't sell anything. The program is just an hour of straightforward Q&A, and then we just tell you, you know, we pay for time on the radio, and we're listener-supported. That's what we do at the bottom of the hour. Instead of taking breaks and, you know, offering products for sale or whatever, we just say, hey, we pay for the time on the radio. If you like to listen to the program on the radio, just know we have to pay. And we don't get money from anywhere, no sponsors, nothing like that, except people like you. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do it from the website, thenarrowpath.com. In 30 seconds, we'll be right back. Don't go away.
As you know, the Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to The Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are continuing our program for another half hour. We have calls waiting. This is a question and answer program. There may be lines that will open up. Our lines are full at the moment, but if you want to call in a little later, you might find a line opens for you. The number is 844-484-5737. And our next caller is Sammy from Dallas, Texas. Sammy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I want to ask a question that's probably not very spiritual, but it was just interesting to me. Topics sometimes have ebb and flows of interest, and one of the interests recently that I heard a lot of people talking about was time travel, which, of course, I don't believe in time travel. But the question is always asked, who would you want to go back and visit or see in time? Of course, my answer would always be Jesus. I want to go back and see Jesus. But then that led me to two questions. Would Jesus be in his humanity, not be able to understand us if we spoke to him? Because we would be speaking in modern language. And the other question came from reading about Doubting Thomas and how Jesus, the discourse between them two, would going back in time, if that were even possible, going back in time to see him in person in his earthly ministry, would that kind of be an offense to him because we should be happy and content with our spiritual, modern spiritual relationship with him? And I just thought I'd listen, get your opinion on that.
Okay. Well, yeah, Jesus did say to Thomas, you believe because you've seen. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. So you're wondering, if I went back to see Jesus, would that be like, is he more pleased for me to believe without seeing him? I don't think your desire to go back and see Jesus would be displeasing to him. I mean, we desire to see him. I mean, we are pleased to have a relationship with him as we do now through the Spirit, but we certainly look forward to seeing him, and the desire that if it were possible, we could go back and see him now through a time machine or something like that. I don't think that's displeasing to him, because we're not doing it because we're doubting. It's not like saying, well, I won't believe Jesus unless I can go back in a time machine and go see him. Then I'll know he really lived. You know, I won't believe until then. Well, that would be displeasing, of course, because that's gratuitous doubting. But if the reason we want to see him is because we want to be with him, we love him and we don't have any doubts about his existence. In fact, we're so sure of it, we'd choose him more than anyone else to go back to see. But no, that wouldn't be displeasing. But as far as you said, you know, in his humanity, he didn't know everything. He didn't speak every language. If we went back there and all we knew how to do is speak modern English, could he understand us? Maybe not. Maybe not. Of course, if he came here instead of us going there, he'd probably speak in English. But as a man of Galilee, he would know some Greek, and he would know Aramaic and some Hebrew. But it's not likely he would know English, because the English language as we think of it didn't exist yet. So, I mean, we'd have to take with us, I mean, there'd have to be as much magic in the communication as there would be in traveling through time. I mean, that you can't travel through time, so it's a moot point. But if you wanted to have the elements of supernaturalism that would allow you to travel in time, you might as well include the, contingent that you could speak in Aramaic too. All right, let's talk next to Cheryl from Everett, Washington. Cheryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. I have a question, but I want to preface it. A lot of people lately have been calling you up and asking how they find their path. Well, my path has been the same. I've tried to change it, and God said, no, don't do that. But my path is changing, God willing, the end of this year. And one of the things I'm feeling called to is talking with people who are in the GWs or Mormons and groups like that. I'm encountering them more and more and more and more. I mean, every day I'm coming up against something with them. Now, I've studied my Bible for years, and that, but I don't feel confident in dealing with them. And I was wondering if you have any lessons on your website that might help me learn some on questions they ask and how to respond to them, or if you know a resource that I could go to learn that.
Well, there's a lot of good resources. As far as the ones we have on our website, I don't have a lecture there on the Jehovah's Witnesses. I do have a lecture on cults in general, and I had the Jehovah's Witnesses largely in mind, and the Mormons, when I gave that lecture. So there's a lot there that applies to dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses, but it's not about them. It's about cults. And then there's a lecture there about Mormonism, but not one about Jehovah's Witness. Now, where you'd probably find in my lectures the most direct refutation of Jehovah's Witness doctrine would be in the series called Knowing God, and especially the lectures about the Trinity and the deity of Christ, which is where my views were sharply different from Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you learned the material in those lectures, and, you know, you would be in a position to argue or to discuss this difference with Jehovah's Witnesses very well. Now, as far as wanting to be more familiar with what's all their problems, what are all their doctrinal problems, there are plenty of books out there. If you go online, go to a bookstore online and just look up, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, you'll find lots of evangelical Christians have written books about how to talk to Jehovah's Witnesses. One guy is named Ron Rhodes, Ron, R-H-O-D-E-S, Ron Rhodes. He's written books like How to Talk with Jehovah's Witnesses, How to Talk to Mormons, How to Talk to Muslims, and so forth. And he's pretty good. I've read some of his stuff in the past. Obviously, Walter Martin was the like the original cult buster guy. He wrote a book called Kingdom of the Cults, where he has a full 50 chapters or more about the Jehovah's Witnesses. And so he's, I mean, there's good resources out there about that. I believe Josh McDowell has written a book about the, you know, modern religious movements and things like that. And the Jehovah's Witnesses will be in there too. There are plenty of books that are written to focus entirely on the Jehovah's Witnesses, and some about the cults will always include them. Okay. So, I mean, I would just say go online and look for books on that subject.
Well, going online and looking is good, but talking to someone like you who's encountered this sort of stuff, you gave me three pretty decent names to start. They're going to be my starting point.
Okay. All right, good.
I appreciate that.
Thanks, Cheryl. God bless you.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye now. All right. Next, we're going to talk to Robert from Indianapolis, Indiana, of course. Hi, Robert. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Good.
Good to hear from you. Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. This is exactly my second time speaking with you, sir. I appreciate your ministry, everything you do.
Let me interrupt just a moment, Robert. Let me just jump in here and say, I could hear you, but there's a lot of echo there. And it's if you get off of the speakerphone, we'll have much better broadcast quality to hear and understand what you're saying.
Okay, is that better?
Not yet. Are you still on the speaker? It's really feeding back and stuff.
Now.
Okay, now I can't understand anything you're saying. So I'm not sure what the problem is. I don't know if you're in a bad spot.
Probably so. Is that any better?
Well, I might be able to understand you a little better, but there's a lot of echo or noise or something, feedback on the line. Go ahead and state your question as quickly as you can, and we can probably endure it. Yeah.
I know it's a question and answer thing. I would come to you for prayer. My life is in shambles right now.
I'm sorry.
Probably I don't want to waste your airtime to go into it, but I definitely, and you don't even have to pray right now. I believe the power of prayer. I appreciate your ministry. I hope you can hear me okay.
Sure.
I'm an author. I authored a book entitled A Letter to the Saints some years ago. And I love Jesus Christ, but, you know, having said all of that, worldly speaking, my life is yet in shambles. And I just definitely would appreciate some prayer. I look forward. Maybe we can get together sometime when you're out in Indy somewhere.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. And Robert from Indianapolis, I know that we have people listening who have prayer lists, and hopefully many of them will put you on their list and pray regularly for you for your life. And as far as life in shambles, there's got to be a lot of people at this point who would describe their lives that way, too. These are very peculiar times and very hard for many people. But we need to uphold each other in prayer. So I will... I'll put you on my list, and I'm sure others will do so, too. Thank you for your call. All right. Let's talk to Mike from Gaston, Oregon.
Hey, this is Mike. How you doing, Steve?
Good, thanks.
Hey, so I wrote you an email the other day, and we kind of talked back and forth a little bit. Said it'd probably be easier just to talk live instead of trying to email because it takes a lot of time. So you probably remember kind of what I was talking about, mass and elders and pastors. And I wrote you again. I didn't see a reply. I don't know if you want me to just read that real fast or just kind of try to summarize as best I can. Or
go ahead. Go ahead. If it won't take too long, go ahead.
Okay. To summarize or just read what I had?
I'll read it if it's not too long. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it was kind of on the long side, but you can always stop me. I'll try to paraphrase a little bit. So it's kind of a summary of the situation.
Yeah, why don't you paraphrase? Because I remember your email was quite long. If you're talking about reading that one, that would take a long time.
Yeah.
Go ahead and paraphrase.
That would probably,
yeah.
Okay. So, you know, we've had a mass mandate in Oregon. We're a small church, 60 to 80 adults. For a while when COVID first started, we didn't meet. Our pastor presented on YouTube. We could watch it from home. Then after a while, we kind of did, you know, half people meeting outside, half people meeting inside. People outside didn't have to wear a mask. The inside did. And there was aspects that some people felt like it kind of divided us a little bit. I mean, you still saw people, but sometimes, you know, it's like, oh, there's the inside people, outside people. Well, then the mask mandate ended. Everybody was, you know, really happy and stuff. And the following week, like only 2 to 3 people decided to wear a mask for their own protection. I mean, you could see that everybody was really happy to be back to just together again, no mask. And I talked with our pastor at some point. He mentioned that he felt like, you know, that it was a good intention. The decision they made there was good intention to give everybody opportunity to come meet and worship and learn together. But then later on realized, you know, in his opinion anyway, it's probably one of the worst decisions they could make for church unity. It's not like we're all split or anybody hates anybody or anything like that. But now we're back to, you know, having a mask mandate again. And I'm hearing that, you know, and this is kind of rumor I'm kind of hearing, so maybe not a good thing, but, you know, I'm kind of hearing some of the elders are kind of leaning towards enforcing it again, which means either you have to wear a mask to come or we split it back into the inside-outside thing and do that again.
Right.
But it seems to me like the majority of the congregation, you know, thinks people should be free to choose what they want. And it seems like a lot of our people feel like, hey, our pastor should be able to lead, the overseers, elders, they're, you know, there for guidance and accountability. But sometimes they're kind of getting in the way for the pastor's leadership. And
right. Well, so you've got three elders that are favoring the mask mandate for the church, and you've got a pastor who favors liberty, and most of the congregation feels as he does. So you're saying
it seemed to be basically the case. And then there's kind of, you know, some people suggesting maybe we don't go to church, you know, and kind of boycott and let them know that's why we're doing it. You know, if you don't want to wear a mask. And some other people are saying, well, maybe we should just go support the pastor, even though he's not asking for that type of, he's not asking anybody to be disobedient or anything. Mm-hmm. But there's some people are saying, hey, maybe we should just go and support him. And so that the elders see that we want, you know, that this is what we want. And so they recognize that. I really want to support our pastor, but most importantly, I also want to do what would be expected by Jesus. You know, I want to follow in a good Christian way. There's all those concerns about, hey, you know, you're supposed to render to Caesar what is Caesar's. You're supposed to follow the general civil laws in general. I want to be respectful to our elders, but I also want to support our pastor, and I need to know how to leave my family.
Okay,
so there we go.
Let me jump in. Sure. Okay, so the issue here is the pastor is inclined to say, well, the government really doesn't have the right to tell us whether to mask up or not. I don't want to force the congregation to mask up. So why don't we just give people the choice? And that's what most of the people in the congregation feel. Also, your elders, I don't know if it's because the government wants them to mask up or if it's because they're fearful of the disease. They feel that they should follow the mask mandate, they say. Now, in many cases, when there is that kind of a difference of opinion, the persons who have the more liberty are expected to, just out of love, to accommodate those who have the stricter conscience, which means, you know,
not stumbling your brother.
Right. If there's three elders who, and maybe a certain number of the congregation who feel like the mask mandate should be followed, obviously I wouldn't agree with them. I agree with your pastor and maybe the majority of the congregation. However, you know, they are the ones who are the inflexible ones. And it's like the flexible ones, for the sake of unity, Paul seems to say most of the time, should, accommodate the inflexible. But there are exceptions. Certainly when Paul said there were differences like that in Rome, he told the church, let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind, you know, in Romans 14, 5. Yeah. But so, I mean, you can go two ways on this. So certainly, we could say that the pastor could say to the other elders, I really think that we should follow Romans 14:5 and let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. On the other hand, if the elders are really bound up in fear or something like that, rather than alienate them and send them packing, we could say, okay, but, you know, we'll accommodate you. You know, for at least for a while, maybe not indefinitely, but I mean, if I were going to that church, although I do not believe in the mask mandate, and I don't wear a mask anytime that I'm not forced to, yet I do accommodate, you know, if the bank or if a market or something says wear masks. Of course, they're not doing that yet where I live, but they may be doing it soon again. When we did have the mask mandate before, I wore a mask, not because I'm afraid of the disease, but because I thought, well, you know, it bothers these people, so I'll just do it. And I think I would do it for the church too. So, I mean, I'm against the mask mandate. I think it's tyranny. I think Christians should protest it. But if there are Christians in the church who are fearful about the disease and feel that it's, you know, that we should be doing what the government says about this, though, I, your pastor apparently thinks, as I do, that the government has no authority to mandate that kind of a thing. Yet, I would rather keep the church loving each other. And here's the thing. If the church required everyone to wear masks, I think the ones who don't feel like they need to wear masks could still wear them and come to church. But if the church says, you know, people don't have to wear masks and there's going to be people here without masks, then the ones who feel like masks are mandatory would just not come. I mean, they would feel, oh, this is a dangerous meeting. I can't go to that. It's a COVID super spread.
In general, I would tend to feel the same too. We do have some people that are very adamant about not wearing them, and one including that seems to have some type of medical issue with wearing it. And I was curious. Maybe not. Yeah. At first, but I do know that he went in for surgery recently and talked with the doctors and didn't have to wear one when he went in there, and they took him in a different entrance or something or other because of whatever medical reason.
You know what
he has,
What your pastor should say probably is like Paul. He said, you know, well, you know, if you've got liberty, you can accommodate the absence of liberty that some other people have in their conscience by just going along with him. But if you don't, if you have reasons not to, or if your conscience tells you not to wear a mask, we're not going to throw you out of the church for it. You know, we're going to leave it up. You're grown-ups here. You're grown-ups here. We're not, you know, we're not talking to kindergarten, you know, students here. We're talking to grown-ups who can make their own decisions about masks or not. But I'm also talking to Christians here, and I just want you to know that if you don't think you need to wear a mask, but you don't, you could, it would be more pleasing to some of the people in the church who have fears that you don't have. And, it, you know, but if you really feel that wearing a mask is going to be bad for you, then those who insist on wearing a mask are going to have to deal with the fact that, you know, that you feel that you shouldn't wear a mask, and they should allow you that too. The, you know, the fewer people who wear, or I should say the bigger part of the congregation that wears masks, the more comfortable those people will be who think they need a mask, you know. But they've got to be grown-ups too. They've got to realize that not everybody shares their paranoias, and that some people actually, it certainly is the case that wearing a mask is not healthy for some people. And so out of love, everyone in the church has to be as accommodating as possible. I don't know how it will turn out, but that's, I mean, the pastor, I think, just needs to communicate that we need to love each other, and that means we're not going to demand our rights unless we have a very good reason to do so. You know, if we don't.
And that's something where I don't know, like, I don't know the elders. I haven't spent enough time with them to really know. I've only been going here about a year, year and a half to this church after we moved. And I don't know them well enough. I worry sometimes, like, okay, is there like, you know, some liberalism or something else, you know, creeping into the leadership
there?
Maybe not. So that's where I wonder, should I stand up or not, you know?
Right. Well, that might turn out to be the case. It may be that the elders who are all into mask mandating, a lot of times that kind of position is taken by the people who have a more liberal political leaning, although it wouldn't have to be tied at the hip with that. I mean, a person could be more conservative and still feel like it's a good thing to wear a mask, and they might even be liberal and think you don't have to wear a mask. But it does, I mean, it does appear that the people who are really adamant about wearing masks are more often than not on the more liberal side of the center. And I don't know whether your elders are or not, but, I don't really know if there's anything else I can say to help. You know, this is an internal relational issue that the pastor's got to shepherd people through. And I believe that, for him to tell the people who don't feel they need to wear masks, that it would be a loving thing toward those who are paranoid, you know, and, for them to go ahead and wear a mask just as a sacrifice you make to make your brother not uncomfortable. And that's what I myself would do. But then also that love requires the other ones who feel like they must wear a mask to realize that masks are not good for some people and can be dangerous for some people. And if you see someone not wearing a mask, you just can't throw a fit about it, you know? You just got to grant liberty to your brothers and sisters. And that's the message that your church needs to hear. Both sides need to hear it, and I think your pastor could communicate that. I appreciate your call. Listen, I'm almost out of time. I've got people waiting, so I need to move along, but I hope that helps. We're going to talk next to Nathaniel from Everett, Washington. Nathaniel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for taking my call. I wish I didn't have to ask another question related to COVID, but a friend asked me for advice, and I wanted to ask you because I respect your opinion. It's related to COVID because he works in the school district, and being in Washington, if you work for a public school, more likely than not, you're going to have to get required to take the vaccine. And my friend doesn't want to take it, doesn't support it, and I agree with him. I don't think he should have to at all either.
There's too many. Go ahead.
Well, my question really is along the lines of does that situation, it's by no means as extreme as the context for, like, the, I can't say, like, the midwives in Egypt,
Exodus,
essentially,
yeah.
Who are basically resisting and lying, essentially, to saying that, you know, the children are being born, or Rahab,
well,
I guess, is an example.
This is, yeah, we're living in a time that's going to really put many Christians into a hard spot, such as we've never had back when we used to live in a constitutional republic. You know, in a constitutional republic, the government never impinges on those kinds of personal decisions. But we live in tyranny now, as is obvious, so we have to, we're going to have to just adjust the way we relate. Now, I would say the vaccines, I've heard a lot of conservatives and Christians and others say the vaccine's totally safe. On the other hand, we do know that thousands of people have died of strange complications immediately after getting the vaccine. So we don't know, you know, and much of that information is suppressed, but some of it's posted right on the government websites. So we know there's, we know there are risks in taking the vaccine. And you know, nobody should, I think, take it if they don't think they should take it. But if they don't take it, they may lose their job. Now, a person has to decide, I guess, if I'm going to refuse to take the vaccine, is this a, there's a lot of noise there, so I'm going to put you on hold. Is this a conviction I have? Like, is this like a moral conviction? Do I feel like God is warning me not to take the vaccine, so I can't? Well, if that's the case, it may be that God is saying you're going to have to change jobs, you know, and that that could well be the case. It's not a thing that we welcome, and nobody should have put us in that position. But if we have to lose our jobs in order to do what we're convicted to do, that's just the way it is, you know. Now, to me, not taking the vaccine is not a conviction like that. The reason I haven't taken the vaccine is it's too risky. There's too many unanswered questions. I'm not afraid of the virus. And frankly, although the virus may be technically more dangerous than the vaccine, I think the vaccine's dangerous too. And I've already had the virus, so I have the antibody. I just can't see any reason to take it. And there are risks involved, of course, as there are with any other decision you make. So for me to not take the vaccine is not a matter of conscience. It's just a matter of, to my mind, it's a personal decision about my health. And if I had to take the vaccine to continue doing what God's called me to do, let's say I was a school teacher and I felt like God wants me teaching in the classroom, well, then I guess I'd have to break down and take the vaccine. But again, if it was a moral conviction of mine, I would have to say, well, you can take this job and put a mask on it. You know, I'm not going to be doing this anymore. Which is a very hard thing to do for a person whose career has been teaching and they're looking forward to retirement and so forth. They're giving up a lot. Christians have given up more than that, even their lives, for their convictions before. But you don't have to make that choice unless it is truly a conviction. In other words, if I was a teacher and I felt God called me to teach and they made me take a vaccine, I probably would break down and do it. Not because I'm a coward, but because that's what I have to do to keep doing what God wants me to do. And I don't have a strong enough conviction that God is against me taking a vaccine. I have a lot of Christian friends who have taken it. So it's a personal decision. It really is. But every Christian, if they have a conviction before God that something is evil and wrong and it would be wrong for them to do, then they'll just have to take the consequences of those decisions, just like Christians have throughout history. It's an ugly time. We've got ugly policies in our country at this time, and we just have to live under them, and just like Christians always have. We're just not used to it. I'm out of time, though. You've been listening to the... Die that went away. Oh, there we are. We are listener-supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, if you'd like to help us out. And I'll talk to you again tomorrow, Lord willing.